Detroit Public Schools will begin the year this fall debt-free, but will the district be able to solve its other pressing problems?
In our special ed classrooms, we saw the release of aides that are absolutely needed.
I'm Lester Graham, in for Cynthia Canty. This hour, we'll hear what one of Detroit's veteran teachers has to say about the district. But first, the Michigan Department of Transportation plans to widen Interstate 75, but there's a snag in paying for it. Jonathan Osting with the Detroit News wrote about that today. Some of the cities along the path of I-75 are required by law to pay for some of this, and others are not. Tell me about this law.
Yeah, that's right. It's a 1951 law, so very old at this point. And it requires communities who have a highway project within their borders to pay a percentage of that project, but only if they are a city or a village with at least 25,000 residents. So with I-75, this is a major project with a very big price tag, and some of these communities could potentially get hit pretty hard.
Give me a couple of examples.
Have to pay a portion of it. Yeah, sure. So Troy is an example. The project is going to be going through that city. Local officials estimate the cost-sharing provision would cost them about $9.6 million between 2016 and 24. Now, when you talk about road funding, that doesn't necessarily sound like a huge price tag, but the issue here is that would be a large chunk of the road funding they get from the state to pay for their local roads. So they're concerned if they had to pick up that tab for the highway, they would have a much smaller pot of money to take care of their own roads within their community.
And then there's some townships in the county, they don't have to pay anything.
Yeah, that's right. Bloomfield Township, the project, the I-75 widening is going to actually start in that area. It's a community of about 41,000 people, so well more than 25,000. But because it's not a city, it won't have to pick up a portion of the cost sharing that Troy nearby will have to do.
Senator Marty Nollenberg, a Republican from Troy, agrees with the city's facing this big bill that the law is not fair. He wants to change the matching formula. How would it change?
Well, he'd essentially scrap that local city match. He says it's not fair. He says with more road funding coming because of the road funding deal passed last year, that it won't hurt MDOT too much to just pay for those highway projects on their own, whatever isn't covered by the federal government, that is. So his legislation, in fact, has raced through the House and Senate over the last few weeks and is heading to Governor Snyder, whose transportation department is generally opposed to the repeal, but this
I bet they are. Imagine it will really mess with their budget and long-term planning. Any hint about what happened? Has the governor said anything?
No, he's sort of typically quiet on this bill, saying simply that he'll review it when it reaches his desk. I think the fact that it was unanimously approved in the House and Senate obviously is going to make it difficult for him to veto it. And MDOT has also acknowledged that while they're opposed because it would hurt their funding, they acknowledge that sometimes it can hit communities particularly hard with some of these big projects.
So here's the big question. As you mentioned, this law was passed in 1951. How is it that this matching formula issue hasn't come up before now?
Well, that's a good question. I think it has come up before. I talked to somebody from the Michigan Municipal League who's pushing this repeal. They say they've been aware of the issue for a while and concerned. But this I-75 project, as I mentioned, is so big, and a lot of the communities along the path were already sort of opposed to it because they're worried about sprawl and they're worried that it's not necessarily going to help them. It's just going to allow commuters to travel through their town better. So I think this I-75 project really gave them an incentive to go after it and try and get repeal.
That's Jonathan Osting, who works for the Detroit News and its Lansing Bureau. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Lester.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Agriculture loves biofuels, such as ethanol from corn and diesel from soybeans. The EPA is also pushing biofuels. They're seen as cleaner burning. Emissions from burning the fuels create a lot less greenhouse gases, which contribute to climate change, than fossil fuels such as oil. All good, right? Well, all those claims might be hyped just a bit. Joining us is John DiCicco. He's a research professor at the University of Michigan Energy Institute. So your research finds that these claims about the biofuels might be a little overblown. So what do you know that the EPA does not know or is ignoring?
I think overblown is perhaps putting it mildly. In reality, claims that biofuels reduce greenhouse gas emissions compared to using petroleum are just flat out wrong, and they come from, I would say, a tragic misunderstanding on the part of a lot of people, well-meaning people who've looked at these issues over the years. Now, EPA is in a bind on this issue because the mandate for biofuel use is something that came out of Congress, started in 2005, was expanded in 2007 under President Bush, and it's required more and more biofuel, primarily corn ethanol, to be blended into our motor fuel every year. That policy was not passed and promoted by the Bush administration in 2007 out of deep concern about global warming. It was passed, waving the flag around energy security, concern about foreign oil, and because, of course, it's great for certain parts of the agricultural economy, in particular corn and soybean growers, and the trade associations of the corporations that make biofuels. So that's the real reason it's there. And a green gloss was kind of put on it, unfortunately accepted by a lot of well-meaning people, even environmental advocates, who thought that biofuels would be greener than petroleum fuels.
Well, it makes sense until you look at the energy required to produce ethanol or biodiesel. We've looked at it for years on the Environment Report and found case after case after case where there's almost as much energy put into making ethanol as ethanol provides. Biodiesel does a little better with soybeans, but there's a very thin margin there. And as far as your study on greenhouse gas emissions, I can imagine if you incorporate everything that goes into making something like that, it's a no-win situation.
Well, that's right. But you know, the problem is actually deeper than that. People have been debating the energy input and output for making biofuel for more than a generation. What's different about my work is that I look rigorously at not just the energy, but the carbon balance. And that's what makes the issue not ambiguous in the sense of what happens to the atmosphere.
Yeah,
well, chemistry tells us when biofuels are burned, the same amount of CO2 comes out the tailpipe as when you burn a fossil fuel. All fuels contain carbon. In some sense, carbon is the fuel of life. Carbo is carbohydrates. We burn it in our bodies for energy. We burn fuels for energy to power our cars, trucks, airplanes, and so on. And whenever you burn a carbon-based fuel, you emit CO2, whether it's you exhaling or a car exhaling through its tailpipe. So if biofuels were to have a benefit, it's not when they're burned. The benefit can only come if when the crops are grown, more CO2 gets removed from the air than would otherwise be removed. And this is the part that everyone has missed. Congress told EPA to use a method that deliberately, in some sense, ignores whether or not you're actually removing more carbon from the air, the cornfields or soybean fields, where the crops are grown. And of course, if you have a soybean field sitting here this year, you're taking corn to use for food and feed, goes into your hamburgers or your Fritos, it's removing a certain amount of CO2 from the air, that cornfield, to grow the corn. If next year you take that same corn and use it to run your car, you ask, well, has the cornfield pulled more carbon out of the air to grow the same kind of corn? The answer is no. That means there's zero offset of the biofuel emissions at the tailpipe, which means the first basic condition is no benefit. Then you add on all the energy and other impacts that people have been fretting over. And it's not that it's ambiguous, a close call. It's that the biofuel is much worse.
So when do we stop pretending that this is such a boon to the fuel economy, to the reduction of foreign imports? I mean, we've done more with drilling, whether it's fracking or any other kind, to reduce foreign imports than ethanol will ever do. Plus, ethanol gets less miles per gallon than petroleum products. So when are we going to stop pretending that this is the great savior of our energy sector and actually realize that we've got problems here that just aren't going to be solved by turning corn and soybeans into
fuel? That's right. Well, I wish I knew when, because this really is a political question. I like to point out, those of us in the energy area all sort of perked up when Ted Cruz won the Iowa caucuses while not fully endorsing ethanol. I mean, he in fact stayed true to his articulated principles of no mandates and thought the mandate should be phased out. So he was the one candidate who didn't essentially kowtow to the corn gods in the way that politicians from either party have been doing for decades. So whether that's a sign that maybe people in Congress are going to start rethinking this mandate that they established, I think we can only hope.
John DiCicco is a research professor at the University of Michigan Energy Institute. Thanks for talking with us.
Sure thing.
Coming up, becoming Amish.
You know, we hug and Bill looks at me and says, well, do you think we've gone crazy? Because there they all stand in Amish clothing. So yeah, that was quite a moment.
How one family's journey in life took them from suburban Detroit to a new faith and life as Amish. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham, sitting in for Cynthia Canty. Faith is a very personal thing. Some people search and continue to search until they find that particular faith which brings their lives into a place which has real meaning for them. There's a new book which tells that story of one family. The title is Becoming Amish. Jeff Smith wrote that book, and he joins us now. And one of the subjects of that book, Bill Moser, also joins us. You two have known each other since you were kids. Jeff, tell me a little bit about your background with Bill.
Well, there's a lot there, Lester. We actually met when we were 4 years old, believe it or not. And I was the best man in Bill's wedding, and Bill was the best man in our wedding. And we just have a ton of history. We made mischief as boys and grew into men and raised families. And then...
And you guys were kids in Livonia.
In Livonia, Michigan. That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right. Bill, after Jeff moved out of the state, you and your wife, Tricia, started a journey of trying to find a kind of religion that would enrich your lives. So where did that journey start?
Well, it actually started, we were living in Grosse Pointe Park, Michigan at the time, and my wife had grown up Catholic, but was growing a little dissatisfied with her personal walk with God in that, and she started seeking other expressions of Christian faith and ended up going to a Bible study. Through that Bible study, she began to see things in a different light, I guess.
And you guys ended up going to an evangelical church, correct?
We did, yeah. We spent 13 years in a evangelical Protestant church and started raising our family in that church. And a very family-oriented church. We appreciated it and quite a bit.
What was the moment that made you decide, hey, maybe this is not for me?
Well, it wasn't just a moment. Over time, as our children were getting older and the teachings that we saw in the Bible, some of the teachings that Jesus taught and the disciples taught, it just didn't seem like we were practicing them in a way, incorporating them into our daily lives. So we began to seek out people that practiced those things more in a daily walk and applied them more literally their lives.
I want to stop you there. Jeff, let's go back to your story. You're back in Michigan, living in Traverse City. You have to go to the Detroit airport. And at the invitation of Tricia, you stop on the way to visit Bill and his family after several years of not seeing him. What did you find when you pulled up to his house?
So I pulled up to the house, and I see a black buggy sitting in their driveway and a horse out in the pasture, and I see no car anywhere. And I'm, you know, just kind of speechless and trying to get my mind around it, and then walk up to the door and knock, and Bill opens the door with his whole family. And if I remember right, I don't think Tricia even told Bill that I was going to visit. So she's kind of a prankster that way. And so, you know, we hug, and Bill looks at me and says, well, do you think we've gone crazy? Because there they all stand in Amish clothing. So, yeah, that was quite a moment. Mm-hmm.
Bill, I wish we had the time to talk about the entire journey from your experiences in Grosse Pointe Park to where you are today. But let's fast forward, and you've become new entrants into the Amish community. You're called Seekers. What does that mean?
It just means that we're seeking a deeper walk with Christ, one that is more integrated into our daily lives.
And as I understand it, this is a label that's given to people who come into the Amish community. Is that...
Yeah, it's one of many, many labels. It's one that probably describes it the best. Others would be, you know, outsiders, English, but Seeker seems to be more encompassing.
Right. The term English, because as I understand it, many of your community speak a form of German called Pennsylvania Dutch, and newcomers, the English, don't understand what's going
That's
on
right.
part of the time. What kind of a barrier is that for you to really embrace the religion and the community?
Yeah, it's different in different Amish communities. The ones we joined was very accommodating to English. They learn English when they go to school. It's their second language in most cases, but they do speak English. So it's just a matter of how much provision the community is comfortable allowing for people like us coming in. And the first church we were in there, first community we joined, was very accommodating.
Now, so, I think the first thing that pops into everybody's mind is giving up cars, giving up computers, and all the what we consider everyday conveniences of life. But it's so much more than that. I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about, you know, what's the transition been like from growing up a kid in Livonia to being in a rural area and pursuing a faith and a life that could hardly be more different?
Yeah, it had its challenges, but it also had its rewards, and that made it very easy to make that transition. The last job I had was in supervising construction. I was driving, about 4 hours a day to and from work. And when we made the switch, it was pretty easy to give up driving for a while.
I imagine. Yeah. Jeff, what kind of questions did you have for your old friend about the life he and his family have chosen?
Well, many of the ones that kind of you've touched upon already, but obviously we did a deep dive on all those things. For me, I guess the themes that I really wanted to explore, you know, I felt this story was clearly a story of faith, and we really wanted to get into that evolution that Bill and Tricia followed that led to where they were living among the horse and buggy Amish, and the story works at that level. I also, just like probably almost every other American, was just plain curious about the Amish and how did that culture work, and, you know, tell me a lot more about that technology thing. Like, how are those decisions made? That was actually really interesting to me. And because I think we're all kind of grappling with technology, like, what do we do? How much, you know, smartphone use do we use and all that, you know, in our modern way. But so how did that play out in the Amish life? And so I thought that was really fascinating. And then I think, too, for me, really, the most important thing and curious thing was, an impressive thing, was how Bill and Tricia made this decision to have such an intentional life. And I think that so many people today are looking for that. Like, we don't necessarily want to just kind of follow the next current that we happen to sort of come into in life's river. You know, we want to be intentional and chart a course, and it's so hard to do that sometimes. And so here, my lifelong friends had kind of the most intentional life I'd ever heard of, and I just thought we could all really just sort of reflect upon our own lives with their example. So that was a huge thing we talked about too, like what, you know, why did you do this? What were you getting out of it? What decisions did you make that just kept helping you kind of keep moving down this path? And a lot of those decisions were not, everyday Americans would think would be very difficult, but to them, the clarity of their vision made it all okay. And I guess that was a really interesting thing to me.
I want to ask both of you, what was the discussion like between the two of you when Jeff was contemplating writing the book?
My first reaction was, oh no, I didn't want to really have the focus on me to be in the limelight. And, you know, as a community of faith, I also was concerned with how others in our community would feel about that. But as Jeff explained, you know, his purpose in it, and coming from where we did, I could identify with the feelings that he was expressing and the concerns, just as he mentioned, those, how intentional is our lives, how much control do we have over our lives. And as people of faith, ultimately God is in control of our lives, but within the decisions that we have to make as fathers and mothers and the family, you know, just how much control do we have over our family's lives and determining, setting the course for them. That was the area that I felt like, yeah, this would be a good thing to share. A lot of people struggle with that, not just people of our particular faith, but I think across the board in our country. It's very much a question in today's society.
Bill, how have your fellow Amish neighbors and friends received the book?
Well, the ones that have read it have been encouraging and just say that it's a message that needs to get out. So far, I haven't received any negative comments on it.
Your lives are very different now. I'm wondering how that's affected your friendship. Did this book have an effect on it as well?
Yeah, very much so. Kind of brought us together more, and that was also one of my deciding factors and just going ahead with it, just the opportunity to spend that much time visiting and talking with Jeff and relating to him again like we used to do years ago.
Yeah. You know, there's a moment in Bill and Tricia's story that really stays with me, and it's in the middle of their transition. They've moved away from Grosse Pointe. They haven't yet joined the horse and buggy Amish, and they're living in a kind of safe house that Bill built, but it was still really roughed in, and like there was no electricity, the kitchen wasn't finished, the kids were sleeping on these kind of stacks of wood with mattresses on top. And so in talking to Tricia, she's like, you know, that was really a best of times time. You know, we didn't have electricity, but you know, we just weren't in a big hurry to get it. And when I think of that and I think about typical Americans and how we approach our lives, and like, who would ever say, oh, my house doesn't really have electricity, but like, I just wasn't in a hurry to get it. You know, it says so much about how they had this clarity of purpose and how it kind of pushed aside so many other things, and that in some ways don't really matter. What mattered to them was joining close as a family, spending time together, having this big garden, and pursuing this life of faith that they were just so intentional about. So I guess as far as something I hang on to out of the book, I just think of that clarity of vision and that purpose and intent, and that's just a huge thing for me, I guess.
We've been speaking with Jeff Smith, author of the book Becoming Amish, published by Dance Hall Press. The book describes how his friend Bill Moser and his family's journey in life took them from suburban Detroit to a new faith and life as Amish. You can find the book at becomingamish.net. I want to thank both of you for talking with me.
Thank you, Lester.
Thank you, Lester. I really appreciated it.
You've probably heard about the state's bailout of the Detroit Public Schools. The district will be debt-free, and an elected school board will once again be in charge. But many legislators, most of them Democrats, say the bailout of the Detroit Public School District is anything but. While a Senate plan was seen as setting up a better future for the district, the House would not approve it, chiefly because of a proposed commission that would determine how many schools, public and private, would be appropriate for the city. House Republicans saw that as restricting the private sector charter schools from building their schools when and where the free market offered opportunity. So, what's it all going to mean in the public classrooms? Well, joining me now is Asenath Jones. She's a world history teacher at Cass Technical High School in Detroit. Let's start with what you've seen during the past several years. How long have you been a teacher in Detroit?
19 years.
As a teacher, what did you see happen in the classroom while Detroit schools were under the control of the state?
We watched our debt increase greatly. When the state officially took us over, we had a surplus, and then that surplus, we watched it dwindle down. We watched constant outsourcing of jobs and just absolute mismanagement of funds. We watched bond money be released from the voters, being released to our schools, and then our schools taken away from us after they were built with the Detroit Public Schools bond money, and then the citizens lost the control of the school board. All that up under emergency financial management.
How'd that translate into teaching kids in the classroom? I mean, what did you see on the ground in the classroom?
Less resources, greatly. In terms of teaching staff, we saw our class sizes absolutely increase, although our class sizes increased from 5 to 7 students, depending on whether it was elementary or whether it was high school. I mean, that made a big difference. In our special ed classrooms, we saw the release of aides that are absolutely needed, that are mandated by the state. We saw them not being placed in the classroom due to a lack of funding. We saw technology that wasn't increased that should have been. But as teachers, we have been resilient. We've made lemonade out of the lemons that we were given, but it was not fair.
What do you think might change for students under this new state plan, this new bailout, so-called bailout?
We're going to say so-called bailout. We're hoping now that the debt has been cleared, maybe, because part of that is a loan to us. And we don't like that part because, you know, basically in 8 years we'll be right back with a $150 million loan payment that we do. And we have no way of paying that back as of right now. But hopefully we'll see some funding of our per pupil allocation being returned to the students and we can actually feel it on a classroom level.
As I mentioned at the top, the Senate had a plan. The House refused it. While the legislature was debating the Detroit Public Schools legislation, two things happened that some legislators say hurt the district's cause. First, investigations of school administrators and scams and kickback schemes. And second, teacher sickouts and protest of classroom conditions. What do you think of the legislators' anger over those sickouts?
First, it was a lockout and not a sickout. Our employer said that they did not have the funds to pay us.
For the latter sickouts, that was the case, but there were earlier sickouts as well.
Yes. For earlier sickouts, it was about us bringing attention to our situation. We understand that that angered the legislator, but they took our voice. The legislator in the state of Michigan was over control of Detroit Public Schools through emergency financial management. There is no school board for us to complain to. There was no avenue for us to go to with the exception of consistently sticking out to let it be known of our horrible work conditions.
This state deal allows non-certified teachers in all grades, and that's not allowed anywhere else in the state but Detroit. What do you and your colleagues think of that?
It's disrespectful to the profession. You wouldn't allow a lawyer to teach without a license. You wouldn't allow a doctor to practice without a license. Those of us who have gotten master's degrees and we're required by the state of Michigan to renew our teaching certification every 6 years at minimum, we are required to take professional courses that cost in upwards of $1,200 a class. And now you're saying that no longer matters. Anyone can come in and teach our kids. It's disrespectful to the students. What are you saying to the students? Anyone should be in front of them, and that's perfectly okay. That's not right.
Some teachers have left because of the uncertainty about pay and the future of the district. What do you expect to happen now as far as teachers staying or going?
I do believe that we will lose some teachers, the new and vibrant graduates that are coming out. I think that they'll go to other districts. I do think that we do not have the things that we need to retain our veteran teachers that we have, and a lot of teachers will probably retire as well. Districts all over the state are opening their arms to them and saying, come teach with us. If they don't want you, we'll come and we'll pay. The disparity in the salaries is almost $30,000 just right across 8 Mile from Detroit teachers.
Asenath Jones is a world history teacher at Cass Technical High School in Detroit. I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, does teacher certification matter? We'll look at the effectiveness of uncertified teachers in the New York City public schools. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham in for Cynthia Canty. The bailout of the Detroit Public Schools includes a provision to allow uncertified teachers, as we mentioned during the last interview. Pam Grossman is the dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. She's done extensive research over many years in the New York City public schools, evaluating the effectiveness of teachers. So as I mentioned, this deal in the state of Michigan will allow Detroit public schools to use uncertified teachers. Did you see that in the New York City district? And how much does that district use uncertified teachers, if so?
Well, New York State actually eliminated the temporary license, which was the uncertified portion of teachers, a number of years ago. And in our research on teachers in New York City, teachers teaching with a temporary license, uncertified, were the least effective of all of the teachers. So it seems like it is not a promising pathway for the Detroit schools.
Define effectiveness for me.
So we were looking at the impact on student achievement. So we used the gains of their students, of teachers, and this was using administrative data that looked at all of the teachers in New York City by those pathways, and looked at their impact on student achievement using a variety of different models. And what we found is that the teachers who were uncertified had students with the least gains in their achievement. So we really looked at the direct impact on student achievement.
We wanted to find out from the legislature why they wanted to do that. And we spoke with Republican State Representative Amanda Price. She's the chair of the House Education Committee. She told us last week why she supported allowing uncertified teachers.
It's another alternative way for teachers to enter the classroom. And I think it opens up pathways for a lot of folks who have a lot of expertise in areas and want to share them. And that's already available in the high school setting, but people who really are passionate about education and would like to have that opportunity in a city like Detroit.
Does she have a point there? I mean, it does bring in diversified staff, even if they are not certified to teach in an educational setting.
No, I think actually this is a very problematic approach, and it's something that we've seen over and over again when there's a shortage of teachers to open up the pathway into teaching and to lower the standards for the profession. Washington State pursued something similarly a number of years ago called the Einstein Law, which again was designed to attract more people with expertise into the classroom. There's no research I'm aware of that suggests that this is a positive approach to, again, improving student learning or student achievement. In some ways, it seems like it's really not serving the children of Detroit by allowing uncertified teachers into an area where they really desperately need really well-qualified teachers. We know that teachers make the biggest difference on student achievement. And so really thinking hard about the kinds of teachers you want to recruit into a district is a very important decision. And there's, as I said, no research I'm aware of that suggests that uncertified teachers are the solution.
I want to ask you, she mentioned it's allowed in high schools under some circumstances. Is having a certified teacher more or less important in elementary, middle school, high school?
I think that at any level of teaching, you would want to know that people are prepared not only with their content, but also with the understanding of how to teach that content. And it's exactly that form of knowledge of how to teach the content that's addressed in certification programs. So I guess my sense is that while that might look different at the different grade levels, not having certification means that you don't necessarily have preparation in, again, thinking about transforming what you know so that students can understand it. My own initial research was actually looking at teachers with or without teacher education to teach high school English, and they all had strong content knowledge. But the people who had not gone through teacher preparation or certification program had very little understanding of how to, again, take what they knew and make it accessible for students.
Pam Grossman is the dean of the Graduate School of Education at the University of Pennsylvania. She's done a lot of work over many years evaluating the effectiveness of teachers. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
Of course.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. For people who get out of prison, often the chances of getting a job are slim to none. There are a few programs to help ex-offenders find work, transition back into society, but finding a company that will hire former inmates is really not that easy. Recently, though, some companies have not just been hiring, they've been recruiting ex-offenders. A Grand Rapids company is one of them. Joining me now are Jahan McKinley, a lead manager at Cascade Engineering, and Kenyatta Brahm, who is a vice president there. Kenyatta, why, when many companies don't, why does Cascade hire ex-offenders?
Cascade is different from a lot of different organizations in the sense that we believe that one of our responsibilities is to help decrease barriers to employment. And one of the barriers to employment is criminal background. So where a lot of companies, when a person fills out that application, they check the box that they have a criminal background, they just take that application and throw it in the trash. And we think that that is not fair, that individuals coming out of prison or jail, coming back into our society, shouldn't have to wear a scarlet letter for the rest of their life. And we believe that we should give those individuals opportunities. Whether your barrier is racism or employment discrimination or poverty, we want to be able to give them an opportunity to be successful. Also, we believe that it actually gives us a competitive advantage, whereas other companies are passing over these diamonds in the rough. We have the abilities to hire these individuals, and they've been excellent in creating careers at Cascade Engineering.
Sure, there's a bit of a labor shortage in Western Michigan too, right?
Yeah, so we're in a war for talent, so we believe you need to turn over every rock. And so individuals or companies that refuse to consider these individuals are missing a great opportunity.
So how did Cascade Engineering get to that point where others have not?
Well, I think it started many years ago where we had a program called Welfare to Career, and we realized that individuals that were on welfare, if given an opportunity and given training and given a culture that supports them, they could be successful. So, for example, individuals that come to Cascade on welfare, their retention rate is 98%, and so that's actually higher than our general population, and we learned that when there is a barrier and individuals are provided support, they can be successful. And so from that Welfare to Career program, our reentry program was created.
Jahan, how long have you worked at Cascade?
I will be celebrating 6 years this year.
Now, your title is lead manager. What does that mean? What does a lead manager do for Cascade?
So it's a lean manager.
Lean manager. Okay.
Yes. And so what it is Fred Keller, our founder, has considered that to be an internal consultant. And so what I do is I get the instructions that Kenyatta and Mark Miller would lay out for the year, and I would deploy those strategies to the rest of the plants.
So this is a pretty significant position, it sounds like.
Yeah, you can say that.
Okay.
It's very important.
Let me back up now. The information I have here indicates you were convicted of a felony when you were 18 years old. You spent 19 years in prison. Tell me about the journey from walking out of prison to trying to find a job.
One of the struggles that I had in this journey, so when you are released from prison, you are given very little resources even about yourself. So it started with me even trying to establish my identity and getting a birth certificate. The struggle was just that difficult. as far as finding a job, there were certain things that you had to, because most people are not even, especially employment agencies, they're not even familiar with people coming out and even wanting a job because of the stigma that they have around people who've been released from prison. They just feel like everybody is going to continue on their criminal activity. I definitely had employment gaps when you talk about work history. And so it started with trying to explain that gap. And once you explain that gap, there was very few doors that was open.
Right. Somebody checks the box, ex-offender, and that gets in another pile, I assume, in a lot of cases.
Yes.
Kenyatta, Cascade Engineering is not only hiring ex-offenders, but is encouraging other companies in Western Michigan to do so. Why is the company doing that?
Well, we're involved in a program called 32-2, and what we're trying to do is get 30 employers to hire two individuals with criminal backgrounds and track it for 2 years. We understand that a lot of companies are hesitant to hire individuals with criminal background because they have all these misperceptions. When we talk about this is the right thing to do, that's a heart argument, and you only can go so far. So there's certain companies that will say, you know what, it's the right thing to do, we'll do that. But other companies, you need to argue the mind, and you need to show stats. And so what we're trying to do is...
Show me it works on paper.
Show them that it works on paper so that a company can say, hey, you know what, I've hired these individuals for the last 2 years, and their retention rate is higher, we hope to find, than the general population.
How's this going so far with the other companies?
So right now we've got 19 companies. We're aiming toward 30. We just had a relaunch last week, and we're going to get that 30, and we're going to begin tracking that. So we don't have the 2 years yet, but we're getting there. But Cascade Engineering, we know that we have a lot of great stories like Jay, and we know that we can allow these individuals to be successful at Cascade Engineering.
I'm wondering how many people are involved in this program. How many ex-offenders have been picked up?
So we've got, for example, Cascade Engineering, we've hired thousands of people over the last 10 years, and I'm sure we have hundreds of individuals that have some sort of criminal background history that have worked at Cascade Engineering. Other companies may have one or two people, but so each company is going to have a different number. One of the things we do at Cascade Engineering is that we allow the person to tell their own story. And so, for example, Jay is a mentor to other people with criminal backgrounds, but there are individuals in our company that the only person that knows they have a criminal background is me. And so that's just our practice, to let that individual tell their story in their own terms and in their own time.
Jahan, there are lots of stereotypes about former inmates. If you had a chance to sit down with business leaders throughout the state, what would you tell them to help them get past those negative stereotypes?
Well, I have had that opportunity. And one of the things that I like to point out to them, because when we are in these meetings, most of them feel like they're sitting across the table from another constituent. So someone who hasn't had a criminal background, that someone's in a CEO position or a VP position. And so when I reveal to them that I have a criminal background, they're kind of taken back from that fact, because they build these stereotypes and an image of a person that they feel fits their particular profile of that. And so I just encourage those folks to just look at what you're asking for out of the workforce, not a person's personal history.
How's that received?
Well, I guess when you look at, you know, the 19 employers that we have, and you look at some of the things that we've been able to do, meaning Cascade Engineering and 32-2, when you look at the things that we've been able to do locally, I would say that we've seen some success, but not the success which is desirable, because we're here. You know, we're here talking about it. So we feel that we definitely have some leverage, but it's a long way to go too.
I find that when talking to other CEOs or executives, they may not be aware of the law. And so it's not uncommon to hear someone say, you know what, I'd never hire anybody with a criminal background. They don't understand that there are EEOC guidelines that prevent them from doing that, and that they actually can be violating the law by having these clear rules that a person won't be considered. So letting people know that, that's the first thing to go, oh, I didn't realize that that was the case. And so we encourage them to have a policy where they look at the individual, they look at when the crime was committed, how long ago, obviously, the crime was committed, the nature of the crime. Many employers have no restrictions. A lot of employers don't understand that either. For example, in manufacturing, we have no restrictions. If you work in a school or a hospital, there may be some restrictions, but manufacturing have none.
That's Kenyatta Brahm. He's vice president at Cascade Engineering. We also heard from Jahan McKinley. He's a lean manager at the company. We've been talking about the effort to encourage Western Michigan companies to give former inmates a second chance by hiring them. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham.
For the past 2 weeks, you've been reading about a bad rag. Today, I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
That, of course, is Lou Gehrig on the 4th of July in 1939 at Yankee Stadium. He was saying farewell to his fans. He added, "I might have been given a bad break, but I've got an awful lot to live for." Gehrig was diagnosed with ALS, more commonly known now as Lou Gehrig's disease. With me is Dr. Howard Markell. He's a University of Michigan medical historian and PBS NewsHour contributor. You write, researchers today are wondering if Lou Gehrig really had ALS.
Yeah, that's the great irony. What if Lou Gehrig did not have Lou Gehrig's disease?
Let's start with the original diagnosis. Why did the doctors at the time think Gehrig had ALS?
Well, he certainly had what's called motor neuron disease, and amyotrophic lateral sclerosis is very difficult to diagnose. You have to remember this is the late 1930s, so they don't have CAT scans or MRIs or any number of tests that we would use today. And so they gave it their best diagnosis, and it seemed to match the symptoms of ALS.
Doctor said he had a 50-50 chance of recovery. Why would they tell him that?
Well, you know, medical ethics were very different back then, and many doctors would not even tell a patient with a terminal diagnosis that he had a terminal diagnosis. They might tell a relative, like a spouse or a parent. And frequently, to buck the guy up, they would say, you know, you could really try to do this. And in fact, one of the last things Gehrig ever said before he lost the ability to speak, he mouthed the words to his wife, "I got a 50-50 chance."
So why are researchers now questioning whether Lou Gehrig had Lou Gehrig's disease?
Well, this is truly fascinating. A group of neurologists and pathologists at the Boston University, this is the group that has been examining the brains of former NFL players and looking at what does frequent hitting of your head do to your brain and to your health. Well, the short answer is not good stuff. But what they found is that many people with repetitive serious head injuries did indeed develop an ALS-like syndrome, but it was really from the trauma itself.
So did Gary get beamed by the baseball that often, or
oh my, happened? Oh my, yes. I mean, he had balls thrown at his head numerous times. He also had grounders pop up in his face. My favorite head injury was he got into a fight with Ty Cobb.
Oh, from the Tigers,
After a Tiger game, and his head hit the concrete, and he lost consciousness. In fact, he hit his head so many times, he lost consciousness on a number of occasions. But because he was the Iron Horse, he never took a day off. And they didn't wear helmets back then, by the way. The only protection was that wool cap they wore.
Is there any way to actually confirm whether Lou Gehrig was incapacitated by brain trauma instead of ALS?
Well, that would be difficult to do. His remains were cremated, and we don't know if an autopsy was done because the Mayo Clinic, where he went for his care, has appropriately sealed his records as out of privacy to Lou Gehrig. You would really need to look at brain tissue. As my old pathology professor at Michigan used to say, show me the slides, show me the tissue. So it's speculative, but there is a good chance that those head injuries caused him a lot of problems in the end.
So what's the lesson to be learned about Lou Gehrig and this possible head trauma issue?
Well, ALS is still a major killer, and I urge everyone to donate to medical research. But if indeed it was head trauma, and you're a parent or a loved one of an athlete, make sure they wear proper headgear and prevent this problem from ever occurring. That would be a great birthday present for Lou Gehrig.
Dr. Howard Markell is medical historian for the University of Michigan and a PBS NewsHour contributor. Thanks for telling us about this.
Thank you.
Stateside is produced by Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Ali Billings, and Lindsay Scullin. The executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Lester Graham. Thanks for listening.